Hey, we want you to support your local public radio station and support our show by going to donate.npr.org/happy. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. The Shape of Water follows in the footsteps of many stories of close relationships between humans and other beings.
Sometimes people take creatures as pets and sometimes as friends. But writer-director Guillermo del Toro's story is of true love between a woman and an aquatic creature held captive in a military facility.
The cast is impressive. Sally Hawkins plays the woman, and Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins play her friends. And Michael Shannon is the brutal man trying to capture and dissect the fish man she loves. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. The Shape of Water is not quite like any other film you'll see this year, and we're talking about it this week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Little Passports. Every month, kids can explore a new country when packages arrive in the mail filled with activities, souvenirs, maps, stickers, and more. Or try Science Expeditions, which delivers exciting hands-on experiments and STEM activities every month. Little Passports has subscriptions and gifts for kids of all ages. Find special offers for our listeners at littlepassports.com/popculture.
Welcome back. Also here is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair this week is noted Guillermo del Toro enthusiast and a correspondent on the NPR Arts Desk, Netta Ulaby. Hi, Netta.
Hey.
You know, if you're wondering, Netta Ulaby, right? You should know the story of the time that Netta told me she went to a party and said, "My name is Netta." And the guy said, "Oh, like Netta Ulaby."
And I think I said no.
Never heard of her.
Well, it's wonderful to have Netta with us. As I said, Netta is a noted Del Toro enthusiast. But I'm going to start off with Glenn. Glenn, how did this fish lady love story strike you?
This is a gorgeous looking movie.
Yeah.
Man. And it starts right away, that opening sequence. Once you realize what that opening sequence, and I don't want to spoil it, but once you realize what that opening sequence is doing, you start to realize, oh, okay, we are now fully in the realm of fable.
Yes.
And that is such a smart shorthand to get us right into that headspace right away. The other thing that makes it clear that this is a work of fantasy is this film's notion that hard-boiled eggs are in any way enticing. They are noxious. They are repellent. They are gelid farts, and it just kicked me out of the movie every time she had some kind of
this is kind of a you thing.
But this cast is incredible, right? So Richard Jenkins, I'd watch him do anything. Octavia Spencer, underused. We can talk about that. And Michael Shannon. But the thing about this film is it doubles down on this whole fable thing so much that any critique you want to lay at it, it can just go, fable. Like, so Michael Shannon, what's he about? Oh, fable.
Yeah.
So Baltimore only has the one doc, fable. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. I enjoyed it. I would recommend people go see it.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's one of the best films of the year, but it's gorgeous.
Netta, as I said, you're a Del Toro lady, is that right?
I am.
Yeah. How did you like this one?
You know, I am a huge Del Toro fangirl. And I, as Stephen knows, I don't let that fangirl flag fly very often.
No.
It's
right.
My job to professionally not like stuff or at least be critical about it. But I do love fans. Mm-hmm. And there are certain little chambers of my noxious little heart where I do just let that fandom fly. And I don't like Del Toro's most popular movies.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like Pan's Labyrinth. And I mean, I liked it fine. I loved looking at it.
Yeah.
And I also wasn't crazy about this one. And it was because I was overly fable-y.
Yeah.
So which ones do you like?
Oh, Devil's Backbone is one
sure.
of my favorite movies of all time.
Uh-huh.
I love any movie where there's robots punching monsters or vampires punching other vampires.
You've come to
or
the
monsters
right show.
I was gonna
punching
say,
other monsters. Blade
we're
2.
We're making a note.
Blade 2.
You know, so Pacific Rim. These
Kronos?
Are,
where's...
Love Kronos.
Yeah, me too.
Love Kronos.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like him when he's a little edgier, and I like him when there's a lot more plot.
Yeah.
And with this one, you knew what was going to happen from the very, very get-go.
Yeah, it's true. It is a little bit like if Elliot and E.T. had fallen in love. It's a little bit the same movie, and I agree with that. But I also agree with Glenn that the simplicity of the story and in some ways the predictability of the story is easily turned around to just be that the story is classic and kind of ageless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of it is the part where I struggled with the fable business because I felt like I do know where it's going. I don't think there was a beat in this movie that I thought, oh, that isn't really what I thought was going to happen. Everyone in it, to some degree, is a type. You know, Michael Shannon, I think, has done things that are much more layered than this.
I think
his five-minute appearance in Loving is more layered than this.
I think when he was yelling, "Kneel before Zod," it was a little bit more layered.
But I also understand why a fable that involves types. I think the type that is the kind of the black friend is a little the most troublesome type, maybe the one who kind of has all kinds of wisdom and stuff like that.
I mean, I think they're setting up this misfit love story where all of your main heroic characters are in some way socially put down. So you have Octavia Spencer, who is her black friend. You have Richard Jenkins, who is her gay friend. She is herself mute. And I do want to talk about, I think, how great Sally Hawkins is in this movie. I think they're trying to set up this story where it's like these misfits kind of band together and go forth, and it's a story of a love story that is shaped somewhat by oppression. But I think some of those characters wind up being paper thin as a result. I think Octavia Spencer, they don't give her enough to do. I think Michael Shannon, they don't give him more than one layer. I was very taken by that Richard Jenkins performance, which I think is lovely and nuanced.
Yeah, and it's also, we should note that this film has as its star, as its protagonist, a woman speaking in American Sign Language. That is kind of huge. That said, there is something slightly disingenuous about using racism to kind of underscore your villain's badness, underscore, and then circle, and then throw glitter at it and write stars around it. And then at the same time, have Octavia Spencer playing the sassy black friend and, you know, Richard Jenkins doing a great job as the sad, supportive gay friend. It's like you're using the racism as opposed to actually exploring it.
Well, and there's also a moment where kind of the, in the same way, I would argue, they're trying to kind of explain how much of a menacing baddie Michael Shannon is playing. And there's sort of a somewhat tossed off threat of sexual violence that's really... It just seems like it's there to say, no, he's not bad. He's really, really bad. And they're just trying to find more ways to do that. And in a lot of ways, the times when I felt the movie most deeply were the times that were a little more weird. And there's a sort of a business where... I'm trying to say how to figure out how to say this, where Michael Shannon suffers an injury and there is some business about the aftermath of that injury that I thought was kind of funny and weird, although later the treatment of it becomes a little bit heavy-handed. But I don't know. I think it is clearly supposed to be fairy tale-y, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably worth pointing out that there's already a little bit of backlash in the deaf community for people who are saying that, you know, if you're going to have a person play someone who can't speak, you should have someone who maybe really can't speak. You know, and this, of course, raises, you know, all of the sort of predictable questions. But I don't know. I did like that we went to the house of Octavia Spencer's character, that we met, that she had a flawed relationship with her husband. You know, as paper thin as all of these characters were, there were at least glimmers of some complications within all of them.
Yeah.
Right. That's it. I mean, yes, they're used in exactly the same way they would have been used in a movie made 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, but they do get more of an inner life. I agree with that.
I think another thing they did in this movie that they wouldn't have done 30 or 50 years ago is they made her a sexual being, gave her a sexual inner life and explored a little bit of how does that work,
and that's a difficult thing to do, right? Because
that's
when you decide you're going to do it, would have been very easy. I agree with Stephen. It would have been very easy to desexualize this entire story and have it be kind of, you know, when we say a romance between woman and fish man, we just mean like a spiritual romance between woman and fish man.
Yeah.
No, this is an actual love story between woman and fish man. And I think they mostly get away with it in terms of the parts of it that could come off as overtly comedic.
And she has a very full and satisfying sex life even before the fish shows up.
She does. That was an interesting
detail. That was a beat, so to speak, that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. But I think it always is on that edge of making her a kind of a twee type and everybody else a type kind of orbiting around her. I don't think it's a plot forward film. I think it's an aesthetic forward film. And I think you're supposed to look at how beautiful it is and how visually expressive it is, which I think it is.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it's extremely successful in that way. I do love this kind of blue-green palette that's consistent throughout. And
although, can I say something about that? You know how, like, it is so much of it is annoyingly on the nose, like the egg, the fertility, the egg timer to which she completes much of her sex life without the fish.
Yes.
You know, a lot of it is just obvious. And the teal palette, which is almost, you drown almost in that teal. Mm-hmm. The perfect combination of the blue of the ocean and the green of the earth.
Yeah.
You
know? No, it's true. I think the funny thing about this film is nothing about it is subtle.
Mm-mm.
And yet, in a way, it worked on me in this dreamy kind of way. I do think some of the visuals of less the romance aspect of it, which they kind of set up in a montage sort of way, and I don't find it particularly satisfying. And then you do get a lot of, I think, beautiful compositions, which
he is beautiful.
You're always going to get beautiful stuff, and there's something to be said for beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There are scenes where the scene almost seems to exist to set up a spectacular visual, especially late in this film.
I think that's right.
I mean, there is a scene set in a bathroom, which, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Linda, is improbable on a number of levels.
Improbable, like, that is generous.
that's not how that's happened.
Uh-huh.
That's
uh-huh.
not how that works. Uh-huh. But at the same time, like, it sets up these gorgeous. There are scenes in the movie that look like lithographs.
Part of the pleasure is, you know, as you say, Guillermo del Toro probably looked at lithographs. You know, just enjoying the almost sort of archaeological layers of cultural references that get piled onto his movies is part of the joy of it. And I did have total moments of joy when Douglas Sirk melodramas are referenced, or Fred Astaire. There's a dance sequence that is a complete homage to Fred Astaire, where, you know, part of the joy is also correcting that great historical error where the Creature from the Black Lagoon doesn't end up with the lady in the white bathing suit.
Right.
That he has fixed that, and he fixed it with an old school Hollywood dance number.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Stephen mentioned the Richard Jenkins character, and that's the place where I feel like it's the least sure-footed.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're trying both to do a little bit too much with that character and not enough. I think either you've got to leave that guy, who, as we were saying, is essentially her gay friend. I think you either have to leave that more subtext or pursue it more, because the way that it plays out felt a little obligatory to me.
Were you guys surprised at how relatively little fishman there was in this film? I mean, we don't get a lot of Doug Jones as the fish
guy.
We see him, but it's really her story. I think that's kind of cool.
Maybe,
that's not what I was expecting.
Maybe it's because it's really hard to shoot underwater.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem they're having with Aquaman.
Yeah.
Well, and I think they also were perhaps... They really do try to make him a somewhat believable actual fishman. I think they have tried not to do too much with he has a face just like a person. So he's not terribly expressive, I would argue. I'm sure there are people out there who are currently plotting, saying he's incredibly expressive. And I get it. But his face is not a terribly expressive face. They have not humanized his face as much as they sometimes do with creatures.
They do more with his eyes.
They do more with his eyes. But I think so much of that is her reaction to him and very simple gestures, putting his hand up and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really all about her. If you look at the main moment when you realize that there is some actual Lady on Fishman action in this movie, it's all about her. It's all about her face and her reactions and how it makes her feel. And maybe that's a good thing.
It's a great thing. It's wonderful to see a creature feature in which the woman's sexuality is something splendid and not something that's like triggering for the monster or herald for some guy to come in and save her.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But doesn't it seem a little unfair? This movie just got 7 Golden Globe nominees. That's the most of any movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the only person who didn't get one was Dougie Jones.
Yeah.
It does seem a little unfair.
Best fish man.
Best fish man.
Best gill man.
Well, I do think, though, I think it's very telling that there's not really an awards category for this kind of work. And people have talked about this
with Andy Serkis. The Andy Serkis Prize. Yeah.
We've talked about this with Andy Serkis. But I do think as time goes on, the idea of what acting is and the idea of what performances are.
And what respectability is also. I mean, a movie like this, it's hard to imagine it would have been nominated for Best Picture years and years ago. I mean, there's something disreputable about so much of Del Toro's inclinations, which is why I'm a fangirl of him.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's great to see, you know, in my spot this morning about it, I was like, you know, there's a movie about a human woman's affair with a fish man, and it's got the most nominations.
Yeah.
It's always interesting to see what people decide as an awardsy type of movie, because I think if this weren't Del Toro, it would perhaps not be. I think it would perhaps just seem like a pretty spangly love story between woman and fish man. I liked it. Sweet movie.
Yeah, me too.
Pretty movie. Tell us what you thought of The Shape of Water. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Before we go, we want to encourage you to head over to donate.npr.org/happy. See? It ends in happy. That's how you know it will make you happy to do it, to support our show by supporting your local public radio station. And then throw us a tweet. Tell us why you gave with the hashtag, it's very intuitive, with the hashtag, why public radio. It means a lot to us, and we thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you for being here, Netta.
Thank you.
You can follow Netta on Twitter at Ulabeast. That's ULABEAST.
I think Del Toro would approve. I hope he would.
Absolutely. I hope so, too. Happy holidays if you're celebrating. And come back on Friday. We're going to be talking about a little movie called Star Wars: The Last Jedi.